Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
British singer-songwriter Molly Hocking first gained attention after winning The Voice UK at the age of 18, securing a contract with Polydor Records. Molly released her debut single, After the Night Before, in November 2020, which she performed during the semi-final of the ninth series of The Voice UK. She continued to build her discography with the release of We Can Have the World Tonight in 2021, her debut EP Up in 2021, the singles Live in 2021 and Bones in 2022. In 2024, embracing her independence as an artist, Molly released three tracks, including You Can't Hold Me Down. Throughout her journey, Molly has maintained a strong connection with her fans, performing live across the UK while steadily growing her presence on digital streaming platforms, now reaching up to 250,000 monthly listeners. Molly has performed at the O2 with Ollie Mers, at BST in Hyde Park, and at the Roundhouse in Camden, as well as supporting Tom Jones, Blue, and McFly. Her music has been streamed millions of times globally and featured on TV and national radio. 2025 marks an exciting new chapter as she signs with a new label, setting the stage for a fresh era of music that's already generating buzz. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Molly Hocking.
Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
Hello, thank you so much for having me. I am currently in my hometown in St. Ives in Cornwall.
At what age, whether as a child or teenager, did you think, okay, I want to be creating music, and how did that journey progress?
You know what? I think the first musical memory I have is when my granddad bought me a fake keyboard, like a ruler size. And I just remember sitting and pretending to play it under the Christmas tree. And I was like, you know what? I really like music. And the first time I realized that I wanted to do this in the future was when I played Mary in the school play, in the school nativity play. You know what they say about kids that play Mary and Joseph? Go on to do great things. Well, hopefully.
What were the next steps?
So I was about 5 then. So obviously, I wasn't quite a professional back then. Yeah. Every chance I got, I was just up on stage singing, acting as well, which brings me on to the next kind of part of my life. I joined a local theatre group when I was 8 years old. And that was probably the best thing that I did because I was there for 10 years. And what it really did was it brought out my confidence, and it brought out a side to me that I use all the time when I'm on stage singing, because it's about performing and storytelling rather than just standing there singing, you know? So that was very, very good to me. I left when I was 16, and then that's when I decided I wanted to audition for The Voice. They actually came down to my hometown, and I got up and sung Amy Winehouse Back to Black, believe it or not. And then that was it. That's where the journey really kind of took off.
The Voice. What was the appeal to try out or go to that kind of show compared to, for example, X Factor or Britain's Got Talent?
Funny you should say that. Very funny. So I actually did audition for X Factor. I think I was 15, turning just nearly 16. And I was in front of the judges, and I was put through by all the judges to the next round. But unfortunately, I got a letter in the post saying that they'd oversubscribed, which was a shame. I would have loved to, I would have loved to have taken part in anything like that at a young age. But looking back now, I wasn't ready for it. So I think The Voice came at the right time, and I had the best time backstage, and just being part of that little bubble, we were a real family.
For the audience who just see it on the television, there are lots of things happening behind the scenes, the makeup, the technical crew, the costumes and stuff like that. So naturally, you've already referenced it was an amazing experience with the family. What other elements would you tell us that the audience would necessarily be surprised to think, oh, we didn't think that would actually be part of what we are not seeing?
Yeah, so the hotel being one of them. So we were all kind of, every time we had something to record, especially when it came towards the end of the show, like the live shows, all of us were put in this hotel across the street from the studios, just outside of central London, Elstree and Boreham Wood. And our call times were sometimes 5-6 in the morning. So we would all meet everyone in the breakfast room, have some breakfast, and then go to the studios for hours and hours and hours. And I think what you didn't see when you were watching is when we would do our solo interviews in the interview room, they actually went on for about 2.5 hours. So it was really intense, actually, for someone so young. I would tell anyone to go on The Voice and do that show, because I think some people think shows like that are kind of pre-staged and people have already decided who's going to win. But from what I saw, that wasn't the case. I never thought I was going to win. Even when I won, I was like, are you sure I've won? Or is it going to be like taken away? I don't know. It was one of the greatest experiences I've ever had. Yeah.
Why did you have that feeling of, is it going to be taken away?
I think that just came from maybe previous experiences in different shows, because you're told you got something and then quite often it kind of gets taken away, or you get told that they've gone with someone else. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I think it's a natural human instinct as well, and one that I have quite a lot, to protect myself so I don't feel extra let down, you know?
Totally get it. Totally understand. Naturally, being in the entertainment and the arts world and the creativity world, there are a lot of no's, there are a lot of doors closing, there are a lot of those type of situations. For you personally, you've got that protection, as you've already mentioned, but how do you maintain positivity and enthusiasm when doors keep closing and things keep potentially being taken away?
You know what? That's a really, really good question. And one that's quite hard to answer, because I think when I was on the show when I was 17, if that had happened then and doors kept closing, I would have freaked out and I would have been like, well, what can I do now? Or is this the end of my journey? Like, this is awful. But I think looking back, every door closes for a reason and it could open back up again, you know? And I think it's about looking somewhere outside the field for other doors to open, because I've had a lot of doors closed for me in my past, I can tell you. I look back and I'm like, you know what? Actually, I'm quite glad that they closed when they did, because I wouldn't be sitting in this position with the most amazing team behind me and the most amazing manager if they hadn't, you know, and if I hadn't have tried to give up a few times. But there is just something deep down inside of me that will not let me give up, no matter how annoying it is. There's always that little thing that's burning to do this as a career.
You referenced that those various doors closed and it's allowed you to be where you are now. Do you think if those doors had opened, you potentially would have been involved or collaborating with maybe people or persons, without mentioning any names, that might have not had the best interests of you as a person, your soul, authenticity, if those doors had opened?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think because you can get pushed down a hole so quickly. And then it's really difficult to kind of shape who you want to be as an artist as well. So I'm really proud that I have this amazing support behind me now, and I can be exactly who I want to be on stage and release the songs that I love and are personal to me and are written about the experiences that I've been through. I've never been as open as I am at the moment in studio with my amazing co-writer and producer, Paul. He's just brilliant. And I think when you meet that right person that you can just, that you can have an 8-hour therapy session with, you know, because it's what it is. It's great. And it releases a sort of stress from your body when you finally have that one song down on a piece of paper. And it's like, this is exactly how I'm feeling. This is where I am in my life right now. Hopefully people can relate to it and love it just as much as I do.
How do you create a song?
I think it's different for everyone. Sometimes it'll just be one word that'll kind of set me off. Sometimes I'll go in with a melody already that's been going in my head that I've got on voice notes. I've got about 2,000 voice notes on my phone of melodies. I'll wake up at 2 in the morning, you know, and I cannot go back to sleep until I've written down what I was thinking. Because all of my best songs, actually, they have been sparked with ideas that have come in the middle of the night or when I shouldn't be thinking about music, you know, when I should be doing something else that's more important. But that's the way of the world. That's how this song was created, actually. I went into a different studio, History Repeating, and I started writing this song, and then I showed the boys when I went into my first meeting, actually, that was quite intimidating, going into this lovely studio. And I played it, and I was like, you know, I'm not too sure what I think of this one. But they turned around and they said, this is a song. It's a brilliant song, but it needs to be changed. And I think that's the thing that would have got under my skin as well. Someone, when I was 17, someone telling me that it wasn't there yet or it wasn't good enough at that moment. But I think it's really important that we can be so honest with each other, because at the end of the day, we want the song to do the best that it can.
You referenced earlier about people thinking those talent shows are staged.
Yeah.
Having been on one and having won one, is there, and this is obviously from in your world, have you ever felt people have had this perception of you, have had the stigma of you from the industry to say, oh, they won this, which means it equals that?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Obviously, I'm not going to talk anything down or...
Yes, is it?
I think that there is a really, really bad idea when you walk in somewhere and they go, that's the winner of The Voice. And I think because a record label came as a prize for winning The Voice, they obviously have to see it through. And it was actually one of the hardest experiences of my life, because I was just like, there was absolutely nothing. I just remember sitting in the room with all the A&Rs and everything, and they were not even talking about my music or music at all. They were talking about the building and showing up around and all that. But my dad builds massive things and he's done St. Paul's Cathedral, you know? So it's not really that impressive. I just remember sitting on that couch and saying, what can I actually do to make you give a, you know?
Yeah.
And they can answer it. And in that moment, I walked out and I've never felt so deflated and disappointed. And actually, I was embarrassed for a good 2 years about being a winner of a TV talent show. I was embarrassed. I didn't want to be a winner. And that's a horrible feeling, you know, being embarrassed that you've won such a big show that hundreds of thousands of people auditioned for. There was a very slim chance that I was going to win it, and I won it. So you know what? No, I'm not embarrassed. It was an amazing experience and gave me this platform, you know? So no, I'm not embarrassed. And I will go on to do bigger things than you ever will. So
Hashtag drop that mic. There we go.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's like the inside of the industry can be very daunting and very disappointing and very turbulent space. But when you find your space and when you find your people that will lift you up, you've got to hang on to those right people. You know, it's really important to surround yourself with the right people and the right friends.
Absolutely. Because it's not only within the industry, it's also the people who you interact with, not family, more the friends. Is like, are they there because they're your friends, or are they there because it's Molly who won The Voice and who's now an artist?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why I don't have any friends. I'm joking. I've got a very good couple of friends, and I'm not going out to Vogue anymore because I'm too scared. I'm really lucky with the people that are in my life, which is nice.
I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month because for me, it's an energy exchange to say thank you to you for all the hard work that you've done. I love the journey of the choice, the unpacking, the booklet, the song from one to whatever number. I'm sure you may or may not be aware, massive uptick of physical around the world. 2 years ago in the UK, 5.9 million vinyls sold, the biggest since 1990. Last year in the UK, there's a basket of products that they gauge exchanges on. And based on these exchanges, they monitor it for some form of tax purposes. There needs to be a high number of exchanges every day for a product to be in the basket. And because of the upsurge of CDs again, CDs have now been put back in the basket. And the research is showing it's the teenagers, it's the younger kids diving into this world, not necessarily the older, nostalgic people, in inverted commas. Then we have streaming platforms that people listen to and consume music on. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
Do you know what? I think vinyl is probably, because I've got a vinyl as well. I absolutely love it. And it's the whole going to the shop and actually looking through everything and picking it up and buying it. I love it. It's that fix, you know, it's like buying clothes. I love that as well. But I think CDs, I'm not sure. I haven't bought an actual CD in years. Number one reason being is I don't have a CD player in my car anymore, you know? And that's where I used to play all my CDs, like the now 25 when I was younger. Because they just used to like suck straight in, you know, into the car. Like that's where we kept them. So I think if they came back, the CD players in the cars, then absolutely there'd be a lot of resurgence of normal CDs. I rarely stream music on anything else other than Spotify. And I think it's just because it's so easily accessible. You can listen to music without even having Wi-Fi or data. You know, it's brilliant. Yeah. Almost too easily accessible.
Do you feel that there needs to be more of an education for the consumers? I'll explain to you why. I was speaking to a group of people, two sets of people at two different times. 10 people at the one time, 8 people at the other. And they are people who stream music. They maybe go to concerts every now and then. I say to them, if an artist has had 100 million streams, how much money do you think they got in their pocket? The first group of people said 50 million. The second group of people said 1 million. And I actually said, no, it's more like 1,000, 2,000. And they were shocked. And
even less.
Yeah, exactly. And they were shocked and horrified. Do you feel there needs to be more of an education? I know Ray, I know Snoop Dogg, I know a bunch of them are saying, hey, this is not okay. What are your thoughts around this whole discussion and debate?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I'm in the ballpark with 250,000 monthly listeners, you know? At the moment, that's after releasing one original song. You don't get anything from it. And there's only a small amount of happiness that can be created when you see how many people have streamed the music and played the music. Great. But I actually, on the topic of this, I Googled my name because I've got a Wikipedia page. I Googled it and it said my net worth. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. So I clicked on it and I think it was something like $3.4 million. I was like, well, I don't know where that is because it ain't in my bank account. Don't tell the tax man that. He'll have me.
Wow. I wonder whether that's just bizarre.
Yeah, maybe they're going off everything that I've done and everything that, you know, it's like, if I have got that sitting somewhere, I would like access to it.
It's actually interesting because I saw an article from Lily Allen and she was saying, so she's got 8 million monthly listeners on Spotify and she's making more money selling pictures of her feet on OnlyFans than she's making off of her music on Spotify.
Well, you know what? I've considered it. You know, it's like, it's crazy. You spend so much time and effort and doing something that you really love and you believe in. And I just think that other industry people that are high up are giving themselves so much so much more pay than anyone else. And they all they've done is press a button, you know? I would like to press a button for 100,000, but it's really hard to elaborate on. But it, the actual creators and the people that are invested and just love doing what they do are really finding it hard making ends meet. And I think that's really sad. Mm. It's really difficult. And it doesn't help that the music industry is now changing every single day. You've got TikTok now. You've got all of the social media stuff that can actually cause more damage than good if it's not done in the right way.
Exactly.
And I think it's about finding the platform that you love the most as well, but not neglecting anything else. Because I said for the longest amount of time, I hated TikTok. I honestly, it was like an evil stepmother of mine. But I've actually, the more I've done it, the more I've got to terms with this app literally is throwaway stuff. So I can put anything up, you know? So that's what I'm doing. But Instagram is my kind of bigger audience and my family. So I think it'll always be like that.
I know it's very secretive in your guys' world. What is coming up? What can you tell us?
So obviously I've been in studio for the majority of this year and we've written a handful of songs that I have just started releasing. So History Repeating came out. And then I've got another one coming, my favourite song. If you like Olivia Dean's new song, you'll like this one. I've just got a feeling about this song. It's my baby. And that's called, I can tell you the name. That's called I'd Rather Lie. Like, I'd rather lie than tell someone else how I really feel. That's the actual lyric than it. But that's what we've got coming out. We've got a few more coming out before Christmas. And I have got really big plans for next year. Well, as soon as I know and as soon as I'm allowed to tell people, I will.
Is this a question that you're still deciding or can or can't say? Is it going to be a cumulative into a body of work of an album or are you still deciding around that?
Yes, there definitely will be. No, yeah. All the songs that I've written at the moment actually could go together in a whole album. So we might actually re-release them when they've all come out as a whole body of work so people can get it all in one place. But I think we're just seeing at the moment how the singles do because people are liking singles more than albums now, unfortunately. But that's the way it is. I mean, vinyl's come back, so maybe albums will come back.
That's why I was asking the question, because a lot of artists I've spoken to, a lot of them like, no, they're sticking with the album. They like that story of the body of the work. And some are saying, no, they're focusing on the single. So I just wanted to see where you're at.
Yeah. And I think it depends on the age group, actually, as well, of the listeners of the artist. Because I get loads of people asking if I'll release an album, which I definitely will, because I like the whole idea of taking someone on a journey through my life, through my messy life. But yeah, no, definitely coming.
Now, what do you enjoy about performing live?
I love the audience. Absolutely love it. And I've just come off doing a support act for Blue, which was brilliant. And I think it's actually just the meeting people and performing and listening to everyone shout back and the whole buzz that you get. It feels like, do you know when you go out and you buy something that you really like and you get all excited about it? There's like that adrenaline spike. It's exactly like that. So when I go out clothes shopping, I get almost the same feeling as when I'm just about to go on stage or I've just come back off stage. Yeah, it's a whole just having fun, I think, on stage, jumping about and seeing people enjoy themselves when they bought a ticket to your show.
Obviously, you've had your own sort of shows where you've headlined and now you've opened for Blue. What is the difference for you? Obviously, you bring in the same energy and intention and enthusiasm to those shows. What are the differences for you for those different scenarios of performing?
I think when I'm at a festival situation or supporting someone like Blue, or hopefully my own headline one day on a big scale, the supporting is different because there's not much time in between the songs and they have to be way more energetic than, say, if I was going to do my own show, I could do more acoustic ones with a pianist and do tracks as well. So I'll do about 6 to 8 songs if I'm supporting someone that they come one after the other and it's all very jumpy up and down and just having fun. Whereas when I do my own headline shows, I kind of talk about my life and It's more of a comedy show, really, by accident, every single time. But there's way more time to talk and elaborate on why I do some things and my issues as well, and then sing them and really just connect on kind of a lower scale level, which is nice. I like the option to do both. I like having options.
Moving forward, there'll be massive arenas of your own headlines, festivals and collaborations with others. Let's just put that out there.
Yes, I will.
Step into it. Molly, I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question today, tomorrow, the next day, I know your answer will be different every time. I understand that and I recognize that. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to five other artists once we finish this conversation, who would those artists be?
Number one being Pink. I've always loved her. She is one of the best artists and performers I've ever seen, ever. The next one is Sam Fender. I just absolutely love every piece of his music. The next one is George Ezra, because he's my future husband. Let's just put it like that. Literally. He doesn't know it yet. He doesn't even know who I am. But that's how it's going to play out.
Exactly.
I've seen it in my head. Yeah. Fourth one is Chappell Roan. And the fifth one is Olivia Dean. Yeah. I just think she's done it so right. The scale that she's growing at is huge. So it's really nice to see an artist doing what she loves and the music that she loves to make her happy and just doing so well. So, yeah.
So, Molly, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
So I will come on tour, stream my music. I've got so many people playing the song in South Africa, actually, because you can see on Spotify where they're playing it the most. So one being America, two being South Africa, and three being Poland. Okay. And then the fourth is the UK. Come on, UK. Where you at? No. Hopefully it will open doors to other countries. So you never know.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.